Lecture slides. I haven't. I have some kind of notes, but I haven't followed them closely. So I probably wouldn't. I do have lecture slides. I have slides from, by the author.
Yeah, that's fine.
So it doesn't necessarily follow what we have done, but they could still be useful.
Yeah.
So even though we haven't necessarily done the same things in the same way, but that could still be useful. Yeah, that's a good suggestion. So we want to take some of today for doing a review before the test, and I guess earlier we will basically continue with our discussion on performance. So in this test we will have now a little bit of instruction set architecture. Instruction set was included in first test, but we had not, at that time, we had not actively used it. So let us include everything about the instruction set architecture in this test. So that is all included, and also computer arithmetic, the things that we have done, those are included. And then right now we are looking at performance, and so we have we were talking about the question of how to measure performance, and the performance is still an important issue. So for example, I just was looking at a newspaper, and there was an ad by AMD claiming their Opteron processor is the best. I haven't verified the claim, but they actually refer to the spec. There's an updated version of the spec benchmark, so they refer to the benchmark, and that is still something that is that can be used for comparison. So question is, how do we compare? And we have seen that if you are talking about performance, then one good way, perhaps the only good way, would be to take some set of programs that kind of represent the typical type of programs that people would want to run, and see what is the execution time. And remember that performance is inverse of execution time. So higher execution time means lower performance. And I was mentioning that now the spec people, they have since then they have other specialized measures also, but we were basically talking about two of them. One is the integer performance. Another was the floating point performance. So there's a set of integer programs, and then there's a set of programs that have a lot of floating point performance. And you can look up these performance numbers and see how a processor compares with the reference machine. Now the reference machine, so whenever they would define a measure, they would also, for example, when we talk about spec CPU 2000, so those are the things that we are defined in 2000. Now there's a 2006 version that recently came out. So there's a reference machine. So basically what you will say is that relative to the reference machine, the integer performance is this multiple. So for example, I gave you an example, a certain Dell machine which runs at a certain clock frequency, 3 gigahertz, 3.06 gigahertz, and it had CN 2000 of 1067. That means it is 1067 times faster than the reference machine, which was the Sun Ultra 510, 300 megahertz. And I was mentioning about execution time for a single operation versus throughput. And these days, a lot of times, what we measure is throughput, because we have a lot of pipelining. So even though it takes a while, it takes a few clock cycles for the pipeline to get full, so until the pipeline gets full, nothing comes out at the other end. But things, when they have moved to the end and the pipeline is full, and assuming the pipeline remains full, then every clock period you finish execution of a new instruction. And so the trend in processor design has been to do as many things in parallel as possible. And last time we had seen one important equation, and that equation is that CPU execution time is equal to the number of instructions executed multiplied by CPI. Now CPI is an important term, so you have to remember this term. Number of cycles per instruction. So this is an average. Multiplied by the clock period. So this is the CPU time. And we have seen that there are different things you can do to enhance performance. For example, certainly you should use an efficient algorithm. You should, programming language may or may not make significant difference. Use an optimizing compiler that will give you a faster program. Use an instruction set architecture makes a difference. Now we have talked about RISC versus CISC. So which type of machine will give you better performance, RISC or CISC?
More computational is RISC. CISC would be a good graphics, something very special instructions.
So you're saying that CISC would be good for things like graphics?
Well, that's why the Intel generally do better at games than AMD will, because AMD was RISC and its grunt work processor just grinds through.
Isn't CISC more or small or fewer, more complicated instructions?
That is true. So CISC instructions are more complex.
CISC is more for the sake of the programmer, so you can, it can be more readable code. For RISC processors, can actually be optimized quicker because it's more basic, right?
Yeah, I think that would be true if you are an assembly language programmer. Most of the programming, of course, is done at the high language level. However, a lot of times there is some part of the code that is done in assembly language. And of course, if you are writing the compiler, then of course you have to know the assembly language. Now, at the RISC and CISC dividing line is kind of not quite clear. It's not as clear as it used to be. So basically, in CISC philosophy, if you have a CISC machine, then for the same high-level language program, you will need fewer number of instructions, because those instructions will do more. However, your clock period in CPI could be higher, because instructions are more complex, so perhaps you need to do more decoding. And this number of cycles per instruction could be higher, because each instruction implies more than what the RISC instruction implies. So it is hard to say. So RISC and CISC, this is of course a trade-off. And of course, there are ways you can have features of both. So you can have most of the instructions such that they are most frequently encountered instructions could be ones that are fastest to execute, but you may have specialized instructions, for example, for graphics and so on. So you could have that part of the CISC approach. Any other questions or comments?
I mean, isn't it just extremely application dependent? Because if you have a CISC processor that happens to match up perfectly with your workload, it's going to run better than if you're running a whole lot of instructions. But if your CISC, if you can't use the really good CISC instructions and end up using it as a basic processor, then your RISC is going to win.
That is true. So if you have a CISC processor and the complex instructions are kind of geared towards the type of task you want to run. Now there's something in computer architecture that we haven't looked at. For example, so there was in the beginning, when the microprocessors first came out, they only had the simpler instructions, had no floating point operations, and then they put in the floating point operations. And then eventually that now there's so much graphics work that they are supposed to do. So there's extension of the instruction set that is specifically graphics oriented, and that's a trade-off. So we were talking about what can you do. Okay, instruction set architecture. So you have choices, and you have trade-offs that as a designer you should be looking at, and then you have microarchitecture, which is lower level architecture, which is again, you have trade-offs. And then, of course, you have, of course, the raw technology. So until recent times, a fraction of the gain in speed came from just better technology, smaller feature size and higher clock frequency. But they are kind of running into problems with increasing frequency, so now they have to do other things. So there are trade-offs, and you should be able to evaluate the trade-offs. And we have seen a couple of simple examples last time. So for example, we have seen an example where you had a choice between two micro-architectures, and we had seen that sometimes you could use a different microarchitecture and have a uh, 1.2 times the CPI and still improve performance, but that would mean you have to increase the clock frequency substantially. Now these days, of course, sometimes the approach may be different. So, because increasing clock frequency is harder, so you have to find other ways of making things work faster. And we saw a compiler optimization example. Oh, did we see that? Compiler optimization example? I think we didn't see that. Okay. Any questions about that microarchitecture trade-off example we have seen? So let's look at a compiler optimization example. Now, a few days ago, I asked how many of you are planning to be compiler writers, And you guys don't seem to be very enthusiastic about being compiler writers. So you guys don't like compilers? Well, I guess if you can write software, then I guess most of you will be writing software of one kind or other kind. And depending on what you get into, maybe you will specialize into different things. But compilers, they still offer challenges. At one time, computer architecture was fairly separated from the compilers. So there were the compiler writers who were writing compilers, and then computer architects who were designing the processors. And it turned out that things really are interlinked. And so for the last, I guess, a decade or so, compiler writers and people who design process, they have actually worked together. And a lot of time you need common skills. So, okay, here's an example. There's a compiler designer who wants to consider between two possible sequences. And let me show the two sequences here. So let me write the code sequence. And let me call them code sequence 1 and code sequence 2. So there is some operation you could implement by... Now let us assume we have three types of instructions. So we have instructions of type A, and we have some instructions of type B, and we have some instructions of type C. And some the instructions of type A have CPI equal to 1. That for these instructions, it takes on average just one cycle per instruction. And instructions of type B, let us assume that CPI is equal to 2. And instructions of type C, let us assume CPI is equal to 3. Okay, and here are the two choices. So choice number 1, so you use two instructions of type A, one of type B, and two of type C. And for code sequence 2, you have four instructions of type A, one here and one here. So which code sequence do you think is good? Is it code sequence number 1? Okay, how many of you like code sequence number 1? Okay, raise your hand. How many of you like code sequence number 2? Okay, so you seem to have done the calculation in your mind. So let's do the numbers. So question is, which one is going to end up being faster, right? Okay, so number of CPU cycles. Now notice here that clock cycle is the same. So we are not considering architectural changes. Architecture is fixed, everything else is fixed. We are simply looking at what the compiler can do. So, if you choose sequence 1, you are going to need 2 multiplied by 1 plus 1 multiplied by 2 plus 2 multiplied by 3, and that turns out to be 10 clock cycles. Sequence number 2, we have 4 instructions. So notice that here we have 6 instructions and here we have 5. So we have fewer instructions here. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it is faster. Because as we see here, 4 multiplied by 1, 1 multiplied by 2 plus 1 multiplied by 3, and that turns out to be 9. So this here is faster. So the compiler writer should choose this. So you have choices, and you have to do appropriate calculation to see which choice will turn out to be better. Now, people have used other measures in the past for measuring performance. At one time, there was a popular measure called the MIPS. Have you heard this term, MIPS? That is the name of our example processor, right? MIPS. And MIPS, it stood, or I guess perhaps still does. Million instructions per second. Now, do you think that this would be a good measure of performance? How many million instructions per second are executed? Again, RISC issue. So, a higher number in terms of million instructions per second for a RISC machine may be misleading, because a RISC instruction may do less work, whereas a CISC instruction may do more things. So this could be misleading. Let us say if it is raw, or if it is native MIPS. So after they realize that it doesn't make sense to just simply talk about how many instructions per second, they came up with relative MIPS. So, for example, using a reference machine, now, at one time, a popular reference machine was VEX 11780, which was a popular mini computer. So people will say relative MIPS, but that the measure is not quite that popular now, because they are better. So better approach would be to use benchmarks. So you have set of selected benchmarks, and you run the benchmarks, calculate the ratios. That is a better approach. Now, I should mention that even with benchmarks, you can cheat, because you know, when you evaluate a machine, you evaluate a machine along with its compiler, right? So so you can cheat, and you can write a special if you know what benchmark programs you will be running. So you know exactly what is that your compiler should do. So you can have some code in your compiler that will make that specific benchmark programs run faster. And in fact, people have done clever things with writing compilers that would that were targeted for the benchmarks. But then they have tightened the rules. So now, I guess, competition is more fair. And then there are other types of benchmarks. So, for example, there is a Now you have benchmarks for servers, you have benchmarks for a web and so on. And then, now, next topic that we will examine, I guess after the test, would be trends in performance, and that is an interesting topic. How, what has been the trend, and will the trend continue? So we have seen that the things have become faster and cheaper. And how many of you think this trend will continue? Okay, how many of you think that we are approaching saturation? Okay, so you think that the chip makers should get out of that business? Yeah, I have been hearing for I think about 20 years that we are approaching the technological limits. We are approaching the technological limits. And then, after a year, I noticed that something happened and they found a way to get around the technological limit. So basically, they just kept marching along. But it seems that they have reached some limit, reaching some limit, especially related to clock frequency.
Well, I mean, you have to. I mean, considering you're moving electrons through wire, at some point your frequencies are going to get so high that you're not going to be able to differentiate between highs and lows. So, if you consider that, in the copper world, you may reach a limit, but if we're going to move to a light processor, then again, we can extend that.
Yeah, I guess so. There could be technological breakthroughs where you could extend that. And I'm not sure what is the status of light processors.
I mean, just announced one.
Oh, okay. So it's the whole processor, or?
It's just the interconnects.
Oh, okay.
There are some technologies using GANs and boards with light, but those are still.
Yeah, there was a big research program actually in electrical engineering department here, which is now ECE department, and they had a number of people working on optical computing, and I was on several of the committees there. So I think in some of the things like in networking, so. And related things. So optical technology has made a lot of gains, but I think computing, I think it remains to be seen how much of the potential they can translate into actual practice. But there were several announcements recently. For example, I think there was one, wasn't there was something from IBM, or I think it was from IBM, that they have found some way of getting around the potential problem, and it may allow for the Moore's law to survive for some more time.
Both Intel and IBM have managed to figure out how to do two more generations smaller.
Oh, okay. So I guess they have time to time one reads the news, Moore's law is there. And I guess just when they announce Moore's law is dead, somebody finds some way. So you never know. Okay, so let's look at the review. So, let me do one thing. Why don't I invite the questions from you? So, okay, on a piece of paper, anyone needs paper? I have some extra paper here. So if you need some paper, so give me two things. You need paper? Paper. So uh, Okay, give me one question. So the question that you want to ask for this review. So and I will try to see which we can respond to that and see what kind of questions you have. And also second thing on that paper, write down a suggested question that you would like to see in the test. And if I like your idea, I might use it in the test. Right? So let's try that. So give me your two things, maybe in maybe 10 minutes or so, or 5 minutes, while we do other things. Okay. So let's do so in terms of topics, I have mentioned that we are going to include instruction set architecture, and there we have seen the instruction formats. So you should be able to use the green card and the set of registers, register convention, and we have seen different types of instructions. We have seen arithmetic instructions, movement instructions, branches and jumps. We have seen pseudo instructions, and we have seen how some of the pseudo instructions are implemented. We have seen assembler directives. So you should be able to write programs. So you should be able to write programs, you should be able to read programs, you should be able to trace through programs. So for example, if I give you a program, you should be able to say what you will have in a certain register by the end of the program. And so important skill there is you should be able to trace the data, and you should also be able to trace the addresses. For example, when you set up pointers, you update pointers, so you should be able to trace through those things. And you should know about the procedure calls. How we make the procedure calls, how we go to procedures and come back, and the conventions about the A registers and the V registers. And you should be able to write recursive programs like the one you did for the lab assignment. And you should know about the stack. Okay, and then computer arithmetic, signed and unsigned numbers. We didn't spend too much time on it, but we have done that before. Addition and subtraction. We looked at design of an arithmetic logic unit, and we saw that how we would implement some of the instructions using an arithmetic logic unit design. And we saw how to make addition faster. We looked at the carry look ahead error, and we saw how you would use extra hardware, carry look ahead generator, to make it faster. And we counted the number of logic levels to see what kind of speed advantage that will give us. Now we looked at implementation of multiplication. So we came up with an efficient architecture which looked like this. Double size register, and this part is involved in addition, and a control unit which looks at bit 0, and it performs shift right. And a plain right. And this was the, I guess we call it the product register. And now since we have this on the board, why don't we run through an example and see how the addition works. See how the multiplication works. Now there's, in the textbook you will find some discussion on division, and we didn't look at division was because in terms of design approach, the approach is somewhat similar, even though division is a little bit more complex, but architecturally it's a similar type of thing. Let's pick the example from the quiz. Now, quiz that you recently did, it contained a kind of random selection of questions. The test would also be a random selection. Now, the two random selections may not be similar, or they could be, because they are random, so you can't say.
Is it going to be the same material, though, in general?
I'm sorry?
Is it going to be generally the same material, or?
The same type of material would be covered, but the questions may not necessarily, some of the questions that is possible may be somewhat similar, but some of the questions could be somewhat different. So for example, I might give you a different type of program and ask you to trace through that.
We're going to be able to use a calculator
for
this one.
Calculator, let's see.
Floating point.
I can't divide.
I meant to ask you about that because I couldn't get the what's the decimal.
The quiz?
But that's because you had to include the one. Okay. What's the decimal exponent? Is that the e to the, you know, once you actually figure it out, the e to the.
Okay, let's take a look at an example. You mean in the quiz?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, let's take a look at an example. Okay, so let's do a little example here of a multiplication. And so let us assume that we want to multiply our multiplier, which in the beginning is here. Is 1011, and the multiplicand happens to be, let us assume, happens to be 0101. So let's make a table, and here is the product register. In the beginning, of course, eventually it would be the product, but in the beginning we start by placing the multiplier here, which is 1011, and this part is 0. And remember that the multiplicand will add in these positions, that is the multiplicand. So this is what we need to do. So this is the beginning, and I guess did we call it step zero? I forgot how we.
Yes.
Yeah, step zero. So and I guess we did call it step zero. And so in step zero, and did we include shift in step zero? Let's see, how did we do that?
I don't believe so.
Okay. Yeah, we said this is the initial value. Okay. Step one included an add and shift. Okay. Let's just follow the same convention. So this is step zero, which is initial. Okay, now we do an add and shift. So this is one, so we need to do an add and shift. So here are the initial values. So since that is 1, so we are going to do a product equal to product plus multiplicand. Sorry for flag so small, but I guess you remember what that is. And shift right product. By product, we actually mean product register. It actually isn't product until we get to the end. And we'll call that step 1. So here, since this is 1, we are going to add the multiplicand, which would be 0, 1, 0, 1. And for this, we just copy. And do a shift right. So we do a shift right, and that would be 0, 0, 1. 0, 1, 1, 0, 1. And of course, now, remember, the multiplier, we have 3 bits of the multiplier left. And then since this is 1, we do the same thing here. So we add this to here, so 0, 1, 0, 1, we add here 0, 1, 0, 1. So we are going to get, okay, I hope you guys are watching this carefully. Where are we? Okay, I add this, right? 0, 1, 0, 1. So I'm going to get 0, 1, 1, 1. And I just copy this. And then I do a shift right product, which is the next step, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 0. Okay, and so now we are left with 2 bits of the multiplier. Step 3. Now, since this is 0, we don't add anything. And we just do a shift. Let's see, did I do something wrong here? Okay, let's find. If I do anything wrong, make sure you are watching carefully. I'm just shifting it, right? 1, 1. And so now we are left with 1 bit. And now I add this. Now, since this is 1, so I add this one, 0, 1, 0, 1, and I'm going to get 0, 1, 0, 1. I'm adding here. So 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, that's what I want to get. So that's a 0, 1, 1, 0, and 1, 1, 1, 1. And then I shift it 1 bit to the right, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, 1. So this one is now gone. So the product now has expanded to take the full double sized space. Okay, does it look like the right answer? So, you should always double check by, and notice that the numbers we are trying to multiply are, this is of course number 5, right? and this is number 11. So this should be number 55 if we have done it correctly. And that is the answer. So that was the right answer in the quiz. Let's go to floating point numbers. Now, with floating point numbers, the first thing to look, if I give you a floating point number, first thing to check is to make sure that it isn't a special case, right? So you should be able to spot special cases. In the special cases, your exponent is either 0 or it is max, that means all ones. So those are special cases, reserved. And then other are non-special cases. And let's look at some examples. Here is a floating point number. Incidentally, some of the questions in the quiz, especially I think some of the floating point questions, they were dynamic questions, so they were automatically generated. So every time you would try, it would come up with a different number. But here is an example. Okay, let's assume you want to convert this floating point number into and let's assume that any bits that I haven't specified here, they're all 0. And let's assume that you want to convert this number into a regular decimal numbers. So first thing to do, to look at, is the sign bit. And of course, this is a positive number, obviously. And now for the exponent. Now we see that this is a normalized number. Right? Because exponent is given by these 4 bits. So this is the usual type of numbers. Okay. And we want to convert that. So let's see, how much is this? That is, this is 128, right? And this is 4. So that is, exponent is, so basically we are looking at the factor of 2 raised to 128 plus 4, that is 132. So 132 minus 127. And so basically that corresponds to 2 raised to 3 into 5. So your exponent is plus 5. And now for the rest of the number, and we call it mantissa. And let us include that hidden 1 there. So this is the hidden 1. And so it's 1010, and we need to convert that into decimal, and we know that it is equal to 1. Now this is sufficiently simple. You know, this is 0.5. It's 0.25. This is 0.125. So this is actually 1.625. So that's 1.625. So the answer is, so the number is, now this is not the final solution, 1.625 multiplied by 2 raised to 5, and you can simplify that. So you can 2 raised to 5 is one way would be to move this decimal point. Other way would be to just take this and multiply that by 2 raised to 5. That means this is 32. So whatever that is. Oh, we didn't calculators. Okay, so let's allow calculators. So you can use calculator, but you cannot, if your calculator has any fancy things like automatic decimal to binary conversion and so on, you cannot use those features. And you cannot, if it is programmable, you cannot program binary multiplication. And things like that. Questions on this example?
So when you ask for the mantissa, you ask for the 1 plus, right? It's not just the, it's not just only the decimal.
Yeah, actually that depends on the context. So, normally we would call it this way.
So on the test, we'll write 1.65.
Right.
Okay. And it also, on the quiz you said, including the sign, is it, the sign's never part of the mantissa, is it?
No, the sign's always the first bit.
Well, yeah, I mean, the sign's always the first bit, but, I mean, it, the mantissa would never include the sign, right? They're considered different things.
That's again, that's...
depends on the context.
Depends on the context. So...
Just a quick question. Is the answer you have there without it being multiplied out the correct answer for the test? 1.625 times 2 to the 5th?
Oh, you mean, is this the final answer?
Yes, we can multiply it out on a calculator, but that looks as good as any.
Yeah, get the final answer. So I want to see proof that you can use the calculator. So give me the final answer, right? So we want to check your calculator skills.
That might be scary.
Okay. Let's consider another example. Okay. What is the smallest normalized number you can represent using 32 bits? Okay, try that. Okay, let's try a different one. Let's try what is the largest. Okay, let's try this one. Find the largest positive denormalized number. Okay, how would we do this? Now you should be able to work with denormalized numbers also. Now what would be the largest number? So sine bit is 0. And now what about the exponent there? Now for the exponent, we know that for a denormalized number is all zeros. And this actually tells you that this is a special case, right? And then largest denormalized number, okay. And I guess that would be 1, 1. Now it would be like this.
That's special.
Denormalized.
Right. Well, what's our special cases? How we have a special case in all 0s and all 1s?
Well, having an exponent all 0s is a special case.
Right.
So that means it's a denormalized number. So we need to find out how much this is. Okay, so how much is this? Okay, this is going to take some work, right?
Yeah.
So, okay, but let's figure this out approximately. Okay, so we can decide this is positive. And 2 raised to denormalized numbers. Okay, how much we need to have here? Minus 126 by convention, right? Okay, multiplied by 0.1111, and let's see how many ones did we say we have? We have 23 ones.
There's
no hidden one. That's why we call it denormalized, right? So this is a denormalized number. Okay, and now converting that number exactly would take some work, right? One way would be to, one approach I have used is that if you want to find out how much this number is, I will find out what is this number. That's what I always do. I will find out what is this number and then subtract 1, which turns out to be easy. But approximately, let us say, what would you say? So now this is almost 1, right? Almost 1, just a little less than 1, right? Because this is 0.5 and this is 0.5, so on. So it's almost 1. So you can say this is almost just a little less than 2 raised to minus 126. And of course, you can do the calculation using your calculator. So that shouldn't be too hard. A little bit of work.
Why wouldn't it be minus 127?
Because that's the way they decided. That is part of the convention, that is part of the IEEE standard. And basically they wanted to keep the numbers evenly spaced so that you can you don't have any gaps. Okay, let's see, how will this compare with the smallest normalized number? Let's try that. Smallest normalized number. Okay, can I collect your questions? Okay, he's going to collect them for me. Thank you. Okay, let's see. Yeah, I was going to talk about, let's see, what is the smallest normalized number and how much would that be? What is the smallest exponent we can get which is normalized would be somewhere between, I guess that would be 1.
1 and all zeros.
Right? And all zeros, right? Okay, so how much is that? So that is plus, of course, and that's 2 raised to 1 minus 1 27, right?
Yes.
Multiplied by 1.0. Okay, does it look correct?
Yes.
So that is 2 raised to minus 126 multiplied by 1.0. So notice that this number is just a little less than this, right? This number is just a little less. If they had chosen this to be minus 127, there would be a little bit of gap. But in this case, this is kind of, it's not totally continuous, but you cannot have continuous coverage if you have represent anything as a binary. But this is just a little smaller than this. Let's look at a question from the quiz. Okay, can you look at generation? Let's look at that.
Before we do that, what did you mean when you asked for the decimalized one?
The decimal exponent would be like this.
Oh.
So that would be there.
Okay.
Okay, let's look at the carry look ahead. Now with the carry look ahead, now you have to use the equations. Now here we have a circuit, and I will show you one part of that only. So here we have those four blocks, and now I'm going to draw only one of them. So you have something called P3 and G3, and here you have A15 and B15. And here you have C4. And so you have to find out this, this, and this. And you were given that the two numbers are A happens to be 0, 0, 1, 1, and other things, and B is 1, 1, 1. Oh, I should align them. 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 0, and other things. Now notice that we know that G sub I are by definition products. So 0, 0, 1, 0, P sub I, lowercase, is, or, so 1, 1, 1, 1. Okay, notice that now this is the second level thing, right? Because these devices have carry look ahead built in. So this is the next level, and we have seen that for the next level, we have a G 0, and actually this corresponds to our G3, even though the equation is for G0, and this is the equation for P0 uppercase, and that actually corresponds to our P3. As long as our A's and B's lowercase, they correspond. So we will find that this is equal to, okay, how are we doing with respect to time? Okay, so let me, so you know that that is equal to G3 plus P3 G2 plus P3, P2, G1 plus. Okay. P3, P2, P1, G0. And this is P3, P2, P1, G0. Now you can see that this turns out to be 1. And you will notice that I think this term is 1. So this turns out to be 1. And notice that our C4 in this case, actually, now this is actually G4, and here we are referring to that as P4. So this, oh, I'm sorry, did I say P? I meant P3 and G3, couple of these. That's what we have in the diagram here. And C4 is equal to G3 plus P3 C3. Now, why is G called G? And why is P called P? When P is 1, the carry is propagated. P is for propagate, right? G is for generate. So whenever G is 1, regardless of what is happening here, a carry would be generated. So generate, propagate, right? Okay, so since generate is 1, this would be 1. And I guess you could argue it from here, but this is enough. So since this is 1, so this is 1, so you know that this is 1, this is 1, and this is 1. And that was the answer. Now let's.
Are you going to provide us with those equations, or should we do that?
All these equations. Now you should be able to get these equations if I ask you to derive those, because the derivation is not too hard. However, if one possibility is that I might give you the equations, but you have to know how to use the equations. So I might try, for example, give you these equations. Or other possibilities, I might ask you to derive the equations, because the equations are basically based on this equation, right? So deriving them is not too hard, provided you know the basic equation. Now there was something I was going to mention here. Yeah. And you should be able to count the number of levels. So why is this a good way of doing addition? So you should be able to count the number of logic levels, and you should be able to say this is how many logic, maximum number of logic levels signals have to travel through. And remember, PI and GI, they take only one logic level, and so on.
So how many levels here?
Pardon me?
How many levels? How many logical levels?
Right, so you should be able to calculate that. Okay. How many levels of logic? Now let's see, how many levels of logic would be set? We had analyzed this in the class.
5.
And I think we have set 5, right? And 5 was based on going from 1 to here. That was 1 from AI, BI to P. No, actually, now this is second level. So we had AI, BI to PI, GI. And then we had the PI, GI to we had the calculation. We had done in the class. So you should be able to do that calculation. So for example, this is one level, and so on. So you should be able to calculate the maximum number of levels. So you need to go from here to here, and you need to be able to go from here to and from here to here and from here to here. So whatever is the longest. So it's basically the carry chain, longest carry chain. So here, so from here to PIs and GIs, which is inside here, that was one level of logic, and from PIs and GIs, from these to these, that was another two levels of logic, and from there, there was another two levels of logic, so I think that's how we had got five. But we have the calculation in the notes, and also it's in the book. But this is, of course, in one of the appendices. So any questions? So I will see you in the test.
As I was taking the test today, I'm set up to fly back on Thursday morning with my sister on time.